Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome back Saifedean Ammous. He is a multiple-time author, and he has published one of the most successful books in Bitcoin history, and we know that it has sold over a million copies, the Bitcoin Standard. Saif, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me, Nick. I'm doing well.
Saif, I want to start with economics 101 for people. I think that with more and more elections happening this year, the idea of big government versus small government comes back time again. I want to get your thoughts on government size and what the governments these days get completely wrong about economics. So I know that a lot of your books and theories are based in the comparison of Austrian versus traditional or Austrian versus Keynesian economics, but maybe without even labeling one or the other, what do governments do that they get completely wrong about economics?
Ooh, well, it's a very big question. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of things that we could mention, but if I were to try and focus on the overarching answer of this question, I would say that it fundamentally comes down to the issue of violation of property rights. And so the way that I see it, really, the most important thing in order for there to be any kind of economic improvement in people's lives, the only way that we can, as I like to call it, get out of the jungle. And this is what I discuss in my third book, Principles of Economics, which really is an attempt to explain all of the things that we as human beings use as a way to economize and to make our life better. All of them rest on the foundation of property rights. We have nothing if we don't have property rights. Once we have property rights, then it becomes possible for us to begin to think about the future, to economize for the future, to start planning for the future, to save for the future. We get capital, we can accumulate capital, we can trade with one another, we can deal with each other respectfully while maintaining our property. And then that allows us to build things, that allows us to accumulate capital, and allows us to start developing new technologies to increase our productivity. And that's how the process of economic improvement happens. And that is how we end up with civilization, which is really the culmination of our attempts at economizing, is that we build this social order where people can deal with one another without having to have strong bonds tying them. You don't need to be somebody's brother or friend or wife in order to be able to deal with them. You can expect to meet up with a stranger and deal with them on the basis of respecting property rights and acting in a way that's mutually beneficial to the two of you. So all of that rests on property rights. And once we have property rights, then everything nice can follow from that. And if we don't have property rights, then everything begins to unravel. And I think if you think of it this way, a lot of things begin to make sense. When people have their property rights secure, they become a lot better at economizing for themselves. They can deal with one another peacefully. They can respect each other. And life is constantly improving. And that, for me, the idea of being able to live in a way in which your life is improving, where you can see that your life is improving, where you can see that you can give your children a better life than the life that you have, that really is more important than any kind of particular material level of well-being that we have. It's not about how much stuff we have, how many toys we have. It's not about any one particular thing that we need. As long as people can feel that they can give their children a life that is better than their own life, then people are going to feel fulfilled, happy, motivated to wake up in the morning and deal with others.
The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by Unchained, the leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with a collaborative multi-sig vault where you hold two of three keys and benefit from a Bitcoin security partner. Purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage vault and eliminate exchange risks with Unchained's trading desk. Unchained also offers the best IRA product in the industry, allowing you to easily roll over old 401ks or IRAs into Bitcoin while keeping control of your keys. Don't pay more taxes than you have to. Talk to Unchained today. Visit them at unchained.com/TBL and use code TBL for $100 off when you create an account.
So really, for me, ultimately, the most important thing is property rights. And the more that a government respects property rights, the better things are for the people who live under that government. And the worse the government is at respecting property rights, then the worse things are. And this is for me, I mean, ultimately, from a purist perspective, I consider myself an anarchist in that the best way of respecting property rights is to just not have a government, because if you think about it, what a government is by its very nature, is the violation of property rights, because a government is built on the idea that this is not optional. You have to contribute taxes, and it's not up to you to decide how much you contribute. So somebody's violating your property in your money in order to take your money and fund the government. So the alternative to that is not some kind of crazy utopia. The alternative to that is just property rights. So the opposite of government for me is property rights, in that you get to keep your money, and then everything that you want, you can obtain by voluntarily dealing with others. In other words, if you want somebody to pick up the trash, you pay somebody, they come, they pick up the trash, and that's solved. If you want protection, you pay people to protect you. If you want a bridge to be built over a river, you pay for people who build the bridge, or you pay when the bridge is used, or people are free to build the bridge. So as an anarchist, I see that there isn't anything that government provides that can't be provided voluntarily. And I think if it were provided voluntarily, it would be a lot better for people. So that would be the kind of optimal ideal scenario, but I'm under no illusion that this is going to be something that we're going to get tomorrow. But that doesn't change my mind in any meaningful sense, because for me, it's in the same sense that ideally I'd rather live in a world in which there's no murder, there's no rape, there's no theft. The fact that theft and rape and murder happen doesn't mean that I suddenly become a fan of those things or that I'm going to take part in them. For me as an individual, I understand that life is better if you don't take part in those things. And I'm practical about it when I think about governments, in that some governments are able to protect property rights better. And I think people like to get into these kind of these methods of organization and these mechanisms for organizing economic production that involve an element of coercion, just because they think they have no other choice. And I can sort of understand that, and I can sort of accept it. And so for me, the important thing is that governments respect property rights. And so that means low taxes, or as low as possible taxes. It means as little intervention in economic activity as possible. It means no messing with the money supply. Ideally, you don't want to have the government have any interference with money supply. So the less the government intervenes in an economy, in my mind, the more prosperous it is. As you see this, you look at a place like Switzerland, which had probably the least government of anywhere in the world up until very recently. Now it's becoming more and more like the rest of Europe. But it was the richest place in the world throughout the 20th century. It was the last country on the gold standard until the 1930s. And it continued to have very high degree of freedom. And that worked out very well. People in Switzerland weren't struggling because of the fact that their government wasn't taxing them a lot of money. On the contrary, they were some of the richest, happiest people in the world. And you see this everywhere you look: South Korea versus North Korea, East Germany versus West Germany. The more that property rights are violated by the government, the more miserable people are, the more poor people are, and the more conflict becomes a normal part of life. This is how I think of it in a general manner, I'd say.
And you mentioned lower taxes, and I think that's at the core of this property rights fixture here, is that if the government is constantly taking a large percentage of your income or your wealth in any form, that is a seizure of property. They're doing so to enact policies that they deem fit, but you didn't necessarily choose those policies. And so in that way, it's the violation. I want to touch on just the bridge concept. Explain more how infrastructure would work without government funding, because people are familiar with the idea of a toll road. So that's not a new concept, but roads were built without federal government funding. And actually, you know, we're learning that the way that roads are gifted to cities through the subdevelopment process, they don't even pay for them in the first place. It's the developers that do them and then gift them to the city. But talk about infrastructure and limited government and how the two can coexist.
Yeah, I discussed this in the last couple of chapters in my last book, Principles of Economics, which I got here. Let me get a plug for it. So this is, I think most people, or well, maybe not most people, but a lot of people are familiar with the free market perspective of economics on, say, low taxes, free trade, these kind of ideas. But then they think, all right, well, that's all nice and dandy. But then when it comes to the big boy stuff, you need the government. You need the government to protect people. You need it for defense. You need it for roads, infrastructure, hospitals, all the big, most important things. You can't just let people have them peacefully and consensually. You have to have coercion in order for them to work. But I look at this critically, and using the work of Austrian economists like Mari Rothbard and Hans-Hermann Hoppe, and I examined the basis for this idea, and I find it to be completely misguided, in the sense that it's really the other way around. It's the fact that these things, or the reason that people think of those things as being important, is because they look at how they're provided in the current world, where they are provided by government and they're massively dysfunctional, and they think this is such a huge deal, and therefore we need the government to handle it. But it's the other way around. It is such a huge deal because the government is handling it. So if we did have, say, governments taking over the potato industry tomorrow, then the potato industry is going to be a mess, and it's going to be hugely complicated, and there's going to be all kinds of conflicts around potatoes, and it's going to be very politically contentious, and you're going to have the potato farmer lobby and the supermarket lobby and the consumer lobby all at each other's throat every day in order to solve this. And then it would be very difficult to convince people that the answer to that is not to pass more laws and to mandate more ways in which the potato industry needs to operate. But the answer is actually just let people do whatever they want with potatoes. But that, I believe, is really the case. That's what you actually need. So the example of infrastructure is a great one, and the example of roads. And so if you think about what is happening with roads, roads almost everywhere are congested, and the reason they are congested is because they are built without having to account for opportunity cost. And so people think, well, we need more roads, so we need to build roads, so the government can take people's property confiscated in order to build road. Do you have eminent domain? Pretty much most places in the world, governments can confiscate land. And so what you're doing there is that you're creating this special category of good for which the maker of this good doesn't face the cost. They don't have to pay for it. So if you want to buy land for a school, for a house, for playgrounds, for parks, you have to pay for that land, or you have to buy it from its owner and then transform it into that use case. But if you want to build it for roads, then you don't have to pay for it. So what's that going to lead to? It's going to lead to an overproduction of roads. We're going to have more roads. So if you have an overproduction of roads, you think, all right, well, that's a good thing, because that just means that we're never going to be stuck in traffic. No, actually, it's the other way around. The fact that we have overproduction of roads means that cities become more and more spread out, because now you have all of these empty areas where humans can't do any living activities because cars pass there and you can't do anything. And so now, because roads are overprovided, because there's no opportunity cost for roads, your school is very far from your work, far from your home, far from your kids' school, far from the place where you go to meet your friends, far from the gym. And so now you need to stay in a car to get around. And that makes life even more complicated because everybody needs to be staying in the car at all times so that the roads become more and more crowded. So the oversupply of the roads is what creates the need for people to get into cars in the first place, in many cases, rather than having smaller areas where people are able to walk and have pedestrian distances, pedestrian communities where you could live and not even need a car because you can just walk in many of those places. Or when you need a car, it'll be for only a small number of your daily trips. So if we didn't have that, then the way that we would structure cities, the way that we would structure all of those things would be built on people calculating opportunity cost. And so if you're building roads that are not an efficient use of space, that ends up being a very economically useless use of resources or wasteful use of resources. And so therefore, it doesn't work. And so people will repurpose that land and use it for other things. And so you'd have fewer roads, or you'd have underground roads. I think this is something that you could imagine happening more and more. We already have a lot of tunnels and bridges, but because we don't have to pay for the opportunity cost, we don't have to pay for roads, we don't have to think very economically, very intelligently about how to utilize that space. And so governments just confiscate land, build roads, and then build communities that are disparate and far apart from each other. And then everybody has to spend all of their days in cars driving around. And there's no reason why that stuff can't be done individually, can't be done voluntarily. And of course, you could argue here that, well, there are benefits to coordinating that kind of activity at a larger scale, that if you have some kind of master plan for a city, then that would be better. And I agree. And I think these sort of things could benefit from these kind of economies of scale that would happen if you had property rights, again, where people would be able to build cities. And then they'd plan those cities and let people come in and let people buy the property. And then you'd see different kinds of building cities, different cities that are built in different ways, where people get to choose how they allocate their space. And you'd see a more competitive process and more learning from how to allocate resources more and more efficiently. So with all of these things, I still don't see why, I can't find a compelling reason for why they cannot be provided consensually. That's why what I would say. But I get into this in more detail, obviously, in the book.
Saif, talk to us about capital. So you mentioned that the objective, the human objective, shouldn't be to acquire things, materialism. It's the ability to build generations and to leave the place better than when you came there. And that has to do with building up capital stock. And so this is something you've talked about in all of your books. So bring it home for people and explain why Bitcoin is capital more so than it is necessarily money or a currency, and how Bitcoin plays into the accumulation of capital, building up of capital, and how that helps the world economically. Because I think that's what people really want to understand about Bitcoin when they dream of a Bitcoin future. What does it mean that Bitcoin is a better form of capital?
So I wouldn't say Bitcoin is capital. I think Bitcoin is money. So I draw the distinction between three kinds of goods. And it's not just me. Mises says that. So there's consumer goods, which are things that you acquire because you value them. So food, clothes, house, washing machines, computers, things that you buy because you enjoy them, because you want to consume them and you want to benefit from them. These are consumer goods. Then there's capital goods. And these are goods that you don't acquire for their own sake. You acquire them for the things that you can produce from them. So a sewing machine is a capital good. Nobody buys a sewing machine because they like to play with a sewing machine, because they like to look at it. They buy it because it creates things. It makes clothes. And so you want the clothes, or you buy a tractor, not because you enjoy riding a tractor. You buy the tractor because you want to use it for farming and you enjoy the food that comes out of it. So these are capital goods. Money is distinct from both of these goods. and that it's not a consumer good. You don't consume it. Money is not something that you consume, and you don't buy it for its own sake for consuming it. And also, you don't use it for production. So you can't make things out of money. You can't use dollar bills themselves for production. You can't use Bitcoin or gold for, well, gold, I mean, can be used as a capital good, I guess. And you can make a kite out of paper money, or you can make toilet paper, as that's been the case in many, many cases historically. So I guess it can be a consumer good or maybe a capital good. But I mean, categorically speaking, these are three distinct categories: things you consume, things you use for production, and things that you acquire purely for exchange. That's what money is. You buy money not because you consume it, not because you use it for production, but because you pass it on. So those are the three kinds of economic goods. And I think this is a very useful way of thinking of the world. Now, I believe there is a huge problem in people's understanding of capital. And it's not because people don't learn economics. It's probably because they do learn economics, because at university, you're not taught enough about what capital is and why it is so important. And in fact, when people think about capitalism, what they have in mind is free trade more than capital accumulation. If you talk to the average person, what do they think of capitalism? They think capitalism means you buy stuff, and they think capitalism means you trade with foreign countries. It's more about the freedom to trade than it is about the accumulation of capital. And you can get, you can find sinister explanations for why this is the case. Maybe some people just don't want you to accumulate capital, but maybe it is innocent. But in any case, the important thing is that there's, I believe, a misunderstanding of the importance of capital. And there's also, of course, the vilification of capital, which you get from, so capitalists focused on trade, and then people who are anti-capitalist focus on the evils of capital. So if you're a capital owner, you're evil because you're exploiting workers, because the worker has to work all day, whereas you as a capital owner, you sit in your air-conditioned room smoking cigar and just make money at the end of the day. And so this is presented as if it is evil. And it is, I think, one of the most pernicious and destructive memes in human history. This idea that the capital owner is a parasite on the workers is completely ridiculous and is massively destructive. Anytime this kind of idea becomes popular anywhere, there's going to be mass destruction, and there's going to be poverty, and there's going to be blood in the street. It's always been the case. People need to really understand the importance of capital in order for us to have a peaceful society, because if we don't get that very simple point, we are inches away from catastrophe. I think this has been the case for a very long time, particularly in the last century or two. And in my book, I get into an explanation of, first of all, why capital is so important and why the job of the capitalist is not parasitic. So first of all, capital is very important because it increases productivity. And my favorite example of this, which you can see on the cover of the book, is this is my best way of illustrating capital. So you could, we used to have these tiny little dinghy boats for moving things around. This thing can carry, what, 50 kilograms or 100 kilograms or something like that. And you can use it to move goods from one place to the other. Then we move to these sailing boats, which are much bigger and can carry a bigger capacity. And now today you have these amazing, wonderful, enormous, mass-produced ships that carry enormous amount of containers traveling all over the world with something, I have the numbers here, but I think the biggest one, I think it carries about 20,000 tons or something like that. I forget the exact number, but some mind-bogglingly large amount of goods which it can carry around. And there's thousands of these zipping across the world at all times, making our modern life possible. You've never dealt with any of those containers, but everything that you own, or the vast majority of things that you've owned, have at a certain point been on one of those massive container ships. So you see, this is capital. This is an example of what capital does. Another example that I like to use is fishing. You can try and fish with your own hands, and that's going to mean you spend the whole day chasing after fish. Maybe you catch one fish. Then if you are able to build a fishing rod, you get a higher amount of productivity. You can catch maybe 5 fish in a day. If you have a fishing boat and a fishing net, then you can catch maybe 100 fish in a day. And then we start getting more advanced forms of fishing boats. And then today you have all these enormous fishing trawlers that can catch, I think, something like 30 tons of fish in a day. I forget the exact number, but it's also in the book. So I think the productivity of one worker on one of these massive boats today is something like 5 tons of fish per worker. So there's, I think, I forget the exact numbers, but there's like 30 crew members on one of these, and then they make some enormous amount of fish every day. So if you're one of those workers on that fish, every day of work, you make thousands of fish. Whereas if you're trying to catch fish with your own hands, you make maybe 1 fish, maybe 2 if you're lucky, maybe 0 most likely. So this is what capital does. And this is why the worker is not being exploited by the capital owner. Because if you don't like it, you know, just go and catch fish with your own hands. That's going to be a lot worse for you. If you don't use the capital that is embodied in these amazing machines, your productivity is a lot lower. And so that's why workers choose to work for capitalists. They don't choose to work for capitalists because somebody puts a gun to their head forcing them to work for the capitalists. They do it willingly because the wage that they get from working with the capitalist is going to be higher than the any kind of production that they can do without their capital. And so this is why capital is very important. It allows us to increase our productivity, to increase the amount of production that we can do, and increase the amount of output that we can get. And also, then that helps us understand why the role of the capitalist is so important. Because how do you get all of these amazing things? How do you have this amazing trawler that catches thousands of kilograms of fish every day? Every single piece of capital on the world, on the face of Earth, every single one of them involves a capital owner foregoing consumption. Every single thing, the microphone you're using for this podcast, it goes into capital production. You could sell that thing today and you could buy yourself a nice consumer good. You could buy your daughter a nice toy with it. And yet you forsake that consumption good in order to keep owning that capital good. And that's true for everything. It's true for companies like Apple. Every single stock owner in Apple could sell their stock in Apple and buy consumer goods. Every single owner of one of these giant shipping containers can sell their share in that shipping container and buy a consumer good. So only because all of those people are foregoing consumption from resources that they've already earned, only because of that do we have these capital goods that allow the fishermen to catch fish with a lot higher productivity. So the cost of capital is sacrifice of consumption. And this is true at every level. If you wanted to go from catching fish with your own hand to catching fish with a fishing rod, the only way you do that is that you have to sacrifice fishing. You give up on catching fish today because you go and spend your time instead building the fishing rod. So you're going to have to go hungry for a day or for half a day. Instead of catching, say, 2 fish in a day, you catch 1 fish because you spend half the day working on building the fishing rod. And then when it's done, tomorrow you go and you catch 5 fish with a fishing rod. So in order to increase your productivity, there has to be a sacrifice. There has to be sacrifice of consumption goods. And so the key for having capital is delayed gratification, lowering our time preference, thinking about the future instead of the present. And that's really where we separate from animals. So animals just act out of instinct. They get hungry, they go out and they hunt. And they don't have the ability to forego hunting or labor, if you want. They don't have the ability to forego the consumption that comes from labor in order to invest in building capital goods that can allow them to increase their productivity in hunting. So, but we can do that. We have brains that allow us to do that. We have reason. So I'm able to figure out that if I just gave up on fishing for a couple of hours every day, then I might be able to build a small little fishing boat that's going to allow me to catch more fish than I can catch if I'm on the shore. And so you sacrifice consumption in exchange for higher productivity in the future. So that's the key thing that you need, is delayed gratification and sacrifice. So lower time preference, in other words, you sacrifice the present for the future. And that is not just difficult because you're giving up something today in exchange for something tomorrow. You're also giving up something that is certain for something that is less certain. So there's no guarantee that just because you spend half a day working on building a fishing rod or you spend a couple of weeks building a boat, that that boat is going to work and the fishing rod is going to give you more fish. It might not work. It might sink as soon as you take it out. It might hit a rock and fall apart. And then all of the work that you put in has gone to waste. And this is always the case with any kind of capital. There's always the possibility of complete and catastrophic loss. You could get an earthquake that just eats up an entire factory that is worth millions of dollars. It can happen. It has happened. And it will continue to happen. So there's always uncertainty. And so the capitalist is really far from being this evil, cigar-smoking exploiter of workers. You could say, you could equally say the worker is exploiting the capitalist because the worker is gaining an enormous increase in his productivity because of all of the hard work that the capitalist has done in accumulating the resources and in sacrificing the consumption of these resources. Every single capital good in the world could be turned into consumption. You know, I mean, think about all of these massive boats. Their owners could sell them today and throw the most incredible parties and have the most amazing time. And yet they don't. Every day they wake up and they choose, nope, I'm not going to buy a party boat and throw the biggest party for my friends and spend the next week on a giant bender of hedonism. Every morning they choose no hedonism, and every morning they choose to keep that boat running so that it can catch fish, so that it can continue to give them an income, which is uncertain. So this inability to appreciate capital, I think, is very dangerous, because what happens in places when people vilify capitalism and capital owners is you take away their capital and you say, let's just give it to the workers, which is code for a bunch of people pretending to be acting in the name of workers. But then what you've done is that you've destroyed the reward for delayed gratification. You've made it so that people who save and forego consumption can't reap any rewards from that. So you destroy the incentive to do that. So nobody accumulates capital anymore and everybody just consumes everything that they have. So what happens when you vilify capital is that you destroy capital. And then once you destroy capital, we see how that works out in countries that have tried socialism. They run out of capital. Eventually, the Soviet Union ran out of capital and capital falls apart. People don't want to save. But also, even if people are forced to save, even if you take people's resources and you invest them in capital production, the more complex idea is the problem of central calculation without property rights. And that's really the real reason why it's not just important to have capital. It needs to be privately owned capital. That's why capital can only function in a system of property rights. Because without property rights, there is no economic calculation. And without economic calculation, there's no rational way of allocating capital accurately. Now here, this is, I believe, maybe the most important insight of the Austrian school. And it's extremely underrated. When you ask people, what are the problems with socialism? The vast majority of people will tell you the problem with socialism is an incentive problem. Nobody wants to work because work is not rewarded in socialism. You can't get rich, so nobody wants to do the hard work. Nobody wants to be the brain surgeon. Nobody wants to do drive the expensive, dangerous machinery. Nobody wants to take out the trash. Everybody wants to have the easy job, and everybody wants to coast along because everybody's going to get the same salary at the end of the day. I don't think this is a serious problem with socialism. I mean, I think it is a problem, but I don't think it is the fatal problem of socialism. And it's not the problem that Mises identifies. Because if you look at socialist regimes, they've managed to solve that problem. And they solve it through another incentive, the structure that is more powerful than profit incentives, which is they send you to the gulag. Nobody wants to go to the gulag, and so people will work. So if you look at the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union collapsed in the 1990s and 80s, they didn't have an absenteeism problem. People were turning up at work. And the few people who didn't turn up at work ended up at the gulag. So you definitely have the incentive issue sorted out. People hate going to the gulag more than they like getting rich. So the incentive problem was sorted out. And yet socialism failed. And the reason that it failed is because of the absence of property rights. And that's really the issue that is the more complex way of understanding the problem of socialism. Because what Mises identifies is this. If you have capital goods, you need to be able to perform economic calculation on how to use those capital goods. And the way to do that is that you need to have a market in those capital goods. These things need to be bought and sold between private owners in order for those private owners to be able to figure out their valuation that the market places on the different uses of those things. So in a free market system where people have private property in their goods, in their economic goods, including capital goods, if you are a capitalist and you have, let's say you produce iron, how do we allocate iron in a capitalist economy? You produce the iron, and then everybody is free to bid for that iron. And so the train factory and the car factory and the ship factory will all bid for your iron. And who's going to get it? The one who's going to get it is the one who's able to bid the highest price. Why can they bid the highest price? Because they can use it the most productively. So that's how we figure out how much trains and how many cars and how many ships we build. The owners of those factories make a bid to the owner of the iron factory or of the iron mines, and they are able to figure it out because then based on what people's preferences are. So people buy train tickets and buy ship tickets and buy cars. And then based on the returns that people, that the owners get from those sales, they're able to bid for the resources. Of course, this process contains mistakes. Sometimes the car factory will overpay for the iron and then they'll go bankrupt or whatever. But it's a process that's constantly rewarding people who make right choices and constantly punishing people who make the wrong choices. And so choices over time continue to get better and better and better. And capital continues to get allocated more efficiently and more productively. Now, compare that to the scenario where we don't have a private market in capital because we have been bitten by the insane ideology of capital is evil. And so now all capital gets nationalized and all of the capital is owned by one entity, which is the government. Now the government owns the iron mines and the government owns the car factory and the train factory and the ship factory. And the government tells you as a citizen whether you get to ride the train or go into the car or go into the ship to take to get to your work. So then in this world, how is the government going to figure out how to allocate things? That's the fatal flaw of socialism. And that's why without private property, you're unable to allocate capital. And it's not something that can be fixed with faster computers. This is what the socialists have spent the last century spinning their wheels impotently trying to fix, which is, look, if we just make better computer models, then we'll be able to figure out where to allocate the capital. But it's not a problem that can be solved with more computational power, because it requires the people who are involved in those decisions to have to express their own preferences in order for those preferences to be translated into allocation decisions of capital goods. So this is why you need private property in capital. And this is why for Mises, he considers the litmus test of what constitutes a capitalist economy is whether you have private ownership of capital. If you have private ownership of capital, then you have a capitalist society. If you don't have private ownership of capital, or specifically what he calls a capitalist society, the litmus test is the stock market. Because the stock market is a market for capital. So you can buy stocks in companies. What those companies are, they're effectively the major capital stock of the country. And so the fact that you can buy stocks in Apple and Amazon and Facebook and move your resources from one of these companies to the other, and the price of the stocks of those companies is out there in the market, is the essence of the capitalist economy. Because nobody decides, nobody gets to dictate what the price of Apple stock is and where Apple should produce things, how Apple should produce things, how much it should produce. All of that is determined by the choices of the capital allocators and the choices of the entrepreneurs and the choices of the consumers. And if they're allowed to express those choices freely through their property in the consumer goods and the capital goods, then you are constantly moving capital to where it is used most productively and away from people who use it less and less productively. So that's why you need private property. Now, why Bitcoin matters for that? I believe Bitcoin is really important for that because Bitcoin allows us to have a form of money that appreciates over time. And therefore, because it appreciates, because it can't be destroyed, it can't have its value reduced through inflation, its constant appreciation leads to it incentivizing people to save more. And if people are able to save more, A, their savings appreciate more, but also because they expect their savings to appreciate more, they save more. So you get a larger stock of savings. And then you need savings first before you're able to have capital. You can never have capital before savings. So you need to forego the consumption of something and have it as a form of savings. And then from these savings, we start having capital goods. So the more our money is equipped to holding on to its value, the more savings we have. The more savings we have, the more abundant the capital is. And therefore, the more abundant the capital is, the lower the price of capital, the lower the interest rate. And therefore, the more capital is available for entrepreneurs to use it in productive enterprises. And that's what makes life continue to improve. The opposite scenario happens with inflationary money, where you're constantly destroying. Of course, the Keynesians sell you the idea that because we're destroying the value of money, people can't save money, so therefore they have to invest the money. But they're missing the point, which is that you have to save first before you invest it. So if you're not saving, then you're creating investments without saving to back them. Then you end up with all of these business cycles and all these misallocations of capital.
So Saif tied that together beautifully at the end. That's really the important thing here. It's not that Bitcoin itself is the capital, but it empowers the savings, and only through savings can you achieve the ability to invest in capital because you haven't consumed it. You haven't consumed what you've earned. You've saved it. And I would recommend people go check out our episode with Michael Saylor, the Corporate Finance Revolution, in which he describes this scenario of companies always having to chase debt financing and misallocate capital, where as if they had Bitcoin as a tool to save, it would completely change the way that corporates structure their balance sheet. And so today, and this is the last question I'll ask you, Saif, you've talked about how the fiat standard and the actual monetary good of fiat is worthless, right, over a long enough time horizon. So if the fiat store of value is worthless, we have Bitcoin that empowers us to save. The stock market you've mentioned as it exists as a form of property because you are indirectly or I guess directly owning that capital stock. So how do you can you summarize your opinion on equities as an asset class relative to these other asset classes and especially relative to the idea of fixed income or just dollars?
I think equities definitely are, it's capital, so it's definitely a good thing. I don't knock the idea of equity ownership. And I think saving is also very important. So I don't agree with this idea that you shouldn't save. I think you shouldn't save fiat, definitely. The fiat money is built to devalue over time. And so if you hold on to fiat money, you're definitely missing out. And I think Michael Saylor really helped me understand this very well. And it really was what allowed me to finish up my book, The Fiat Standard, and really understand how fiat money works. It was Michael Saylor's explanation of the fact that this is what we rich people do. We don't hold fiat. We get into negative fiat balances and we hold hard assets. That's basically what Michael Saylor is doing with Bitcoin, but it's what rich people have been doing for a century before. They buy hard assets, real estate, stocks, and productive assets, which appreciate over time because they're productive, and whereas the money that they are measured with is constantly devaluing. So the right strategy in a fiat system is to get into debt. But, I think the tragedy of the fiat system is that that is the correct strategy, because getting into debt is psychologically and morally exhausting for most people. It's very risky. It's very dangerous. And it's a there's always a risk with it. And then the risk with it is very different from world. If you have hard money, you accumulate savings and then you invest some of those savings. And then if the saving, if your investment goes wrong, you lose the capital you've invested, but you still have savings. So you don't end up on the street. Whereas in a world in which you're running a negative balance of fiat, you're in debt. Something goes wrong, you miss a couple of payments, you're out on the street, you lose your business, and your business gets sold off. So it's a really sad situation where people find themselves in, where you have to take irresponsible risk or keep watching yourself get poorer. In a sense, it's irresponsible to not be irresponsible, because you're just letting your wealth disappear. All of the wisdom that people have, and this is, I think, something that's very sad. If you look back over your life, you'll see a lot of people who, conscientious people, smart people, hardworking people, they got into really difficult fields where they worked really hard to become doctors, engineers, all kinds of good careers. And they followed the advice that they'd heard from their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, which is always save, always make sure you have money. And you see just how life is constantly getting harder for them, because their savings are constantly losing value. They cannot accumulate the savings they need in order to buy the things that they want. And the harder they work, the more their money is devalued. And so they're constantly effectively running on a treadmill and they're unable to get ahead. So this is how I think it works in a fiat system. But with Bitcoin, you're able to hold a hard asset. So therefore, the asset itself appreciates. So then you have the freedom to accumulate savings over time and then buy capital goods from those savings when you reach a certain point, and then have a basic margin of safety and a cushion and a nest egg that is in a hard asset that is not being devalued. So this is how I see the difference between the two. Now, when it comes to fixed income and the comparison with fixed income, my view is that bonds are really creatures of fiat. And I know they existed before fiat money came about, but I think under the gold standard, the monetary system under gold, under the gold standard, contained a significant element of fiat, if you want, in that in 1900, the amount of dollars in circulation in the U.S. economy was a lot larger than the amount of gold that was held backing that dollars. And so because the vast majority of people aren't going to turn up at the same time to ask for their dollars, and because people had no choice but to use the monopoly banking systems, there were always rules and laws that restricted entry and exit out of banking. And so therefore, there was always a certain degree of monopolization. That means that banks are constantly creating more money than they have gold. And so therefore, effectively, there was a certain degree of inflationism baked into the gold standard. And I think if we didn't have that, if we had a truly strict gold standard where all money and all credit was fully backed by physical gold, then you would have seen a lot more deflation. You would have seen a lot more drop in prices and a lot more improvement in quality of life. And I don't think you'd see a bond market. I think the bond market was, in an extent, just a product of this inflationism, because it's this inflationism that allows banks to buy bonds. And then the governments, what they used to do in the U.S., for instance, is that the regulations were placed so that banks could count their government bonds as being as good as gold on their balance sheet. And from there, you know, comes the idea that government debt is as good as gold, which has been the root of all kinds of catastrophes over the last century, because people treat it as if it is as good as gold. But then almost inevitably, it always blows up every few decades. And it's a system that works well for the banks. It's a system that works well for the governments because they get to finance themselves. So it's a mutually beneficial relationship. Banks get to finance their spending at the expense of the future, because they're going to pay back that debt in taxes in the future. And banks benefit because they are going to generate all of this money and earn interest on it. And the holder of money is losing because the money is being devalued, or at least it's not experiencing the deflation that it would have experienced otherwise. So I think in the 20th century, this, of course, went into overdrive because then you had a complete separation between the value of money and the value of gold. So then there was no limit on how much money you could create. And so therefore, well, I mean, not no limit, but you could create a lot more money. And that means the money is constantly losing value. And so then this creates the need for bonds, because with the money losing its value, you can't just hold on to the money. Because if you just hold on to the money, as you said, you're losing. And so now you need to borrow in order to operate profitably. So that applies for governments. So governments borrow, and that's how they protect themselves from the inflation. And so governments are the biggest borrowers. So governments are the biggest Michael Saylor strategy adopters, effectively, because they are the largest borrowers. And the second biggest borrowers are the banking system and the big banks. And so those people had the biggest negative fiat balances. So they're the ones who are benefiting the most from the devaluation of fiat, because their liabilities are the largest, and their liabilities are in fiat, and they're being devalued. So this is how I think the system is rigged in order for this to continue to be the case. And so people don't quite see this because it's very complicated. It's very difficult to understand what is going on with bonds and government spending and the relationship between all of that. But again, if you don't know who the sucker is at the poker table, then it's you. And so it works out for the banks, it works out for the government. It doesn't work out for the average person. And what's really exciting about Bitcoin is that you can opt out with this. You can just hold Bitcoin and then you don't have to hold bonds.
Saifedean Ammous, three-time author, The Bitcoin Standard, The Fiat Standard, and Principles of Economics. Please tell people where they can find your books and your courses.
Yeah, saifedean.com is my website, and my courses are and my books are available for sale there. And you can also join as a member. And I also have the Bitcoin Standard podcast, which has a weekly episode discussing all kinds of issues on Bitcoin, fiat, and current affairs. And also, I'm pretty active on Twitter, where I'm constantly railing against all kinds of bogeymen around the world.
Saifedean, thanks again for joining us, and we'll catch you guys next time.
All right, man. Thanks a lot for having me. Take care.